When you hear sound, when you hear radio, you hear the propagation of waves.
We're here with Brian DeWan, who is one of the many artists in Groundswell at the Alamo State Historic Site, Saturday, September 19th from 1 to 5 p.m. Also performing or exhibiting that day is the John Cage Trust with Seth Chrisman, John Cleeter, Gambletron, Tyson Hoff, Bernard Klug, Leovid, Douglas Repetto, and Quintron. All Saturday, September 19th. From 1 to 5 p.m. at the Alana State Historic Site. Groundswell is a exhibition of presented with the Alana Partnership. It's the third iteration of the award-winning exhibition event Groundswell, with over a dozen artists reflecting on and reacting to Alana and its integral viewshed as an ambitious and early environmental work.
I'm a little winded.
That's all right.
Alana's 250-acre landscape was originally designed in response to its essential and spectacular views, the Alana Viewshed, by Hudson River School artist Frederick Church. Audiences will explore the property's undiscovered roads and naturalistic scenes as they encounter each project site. Food and drink will be available from Daughter's Fair and Ale, and at 4 p.m., Quintron will perform the culminating performance of the event, and there's a rain date Sunday, September 20th, in case of rain, but it's scheduled now for Saturday, September 19th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Alana State Historic Site. And Brian DeWan is here to tell us about what he's going to do there.
Yes, well, I'll be there doing a combination of things over the span of a few hours. Some of it will be a kind of oration from behind an outdoor podium, where I'll be reading out loud from some of the correspondence of Frederick Church. And of course, Olana is Frederick Church's home, his estate. And many of these letters were written, you know, between 1870 and the 1890s. And it's been interesting to read these letters. They have them typed in binders at Olana there in their archives. And sometimes they even reproduce some little drawings that he included in letters to his friends. And some of them are very charming, the drawings. There's a little line drawing he did of a face that he sent to his friend Osborne. And then he says to Osborne in the letter at the end, "This head was drawn by my left hand. Copy it with your left hand and send it to me." That was from November of 1875. And so you see this very deft little drawing that he drew with his left hand, his right hand being his dominant hand. So it was funny just to see this playful moment of him trying to draw something with his left hand and asking his friend to do it. It's almost like a game of telephone or exquisite corpse. Draw this with your left hand and send it back.
Were you familiar with Church's work before, or Olana? I guess, can you see your house from Olana, from where you're performing?
I've tried to see my house from there, but I think it's too obscured. But I can see where it is, and because it's not so far from the Thomas Cole House, which I think was more visible in the old days, that you could see Frederick Church's mentor's house, Thomas Cole's house, right from his house there. And, you know, I think even more so from the upper floor. It's such a wonderful vantage point, you know, from the bedroom up there, from his bell tower. And
he had a similar view of the Catskill Mountains, I guess, as Church.
Oh, yeah. It's just an incredible view. And then, of course, from there, you're at this higher elevation, so you really just see out. It's so spectacular. And just yesterday, when I was up at Olana, I saw the letter in which he says, you know, it's when his rheumatism is getting worse and he's having more difficulty painting and getting more involved in landscaping on the estate. And pruning trees and making plantings and opening views. And he said, this is an even better way to make landscapes than fooling around with paint and canvas. And so it was interesting to see him making that transposition of being so involved with landscape and views and being a painter. And as it became more difficult to do so, him just, you know, getting into actually moving things around on the landscape itself and becoming more involved in that.
What were you struck when you read through his writings? Were you surprised about something?
Well, I was surprised just because I didn't know what to expect. I had seen, you know, I've seen his paintings, and I've been to Olana a number of times and admired it greatly. But also in reading some books, seeing more of his sketches and pen drawings that are more informal, that I thought were really deft, wonderful things. And usually don't see those because, you know, he's really famous for his paintings, and that is the finished work. But also I found out in reading his letters, they usually begin with some kind of, you know, more formal introduction or something just telling you about day-to-day life. And then somewhere in the middle, he'll say something very candid or very playful, or sometimes this emotion really creeps in, particularly when he was having his Niagara Falls painting restored because there was a problem with the canvas and there were these cracks that were appearing or some sort of problems in the canvas, and he needed to have it restored. And he had a very high opinion of this painting restorer, but he was worried that he was a procrastinator and that it would take a long time. And he even mentioned specifically in a letter, the problem with leaving a painting at a place like that is that it's more vulnerable to fire and other accidents. The more it's in somebody's hand, you know, some bad thing is going to happen unless you get it out of there before too long. But apparently he was very unhappy with the work that was done on it and felt like so much of layers of scumbling and paint had been stripped away and that he had damaged and ruined the painting, or and he was getting more and more angry about it in the letters. So you kind of see over time he's letting his hair down more and more and describing his annoyance. But he's very funny. There's a lot of evocative things in the letter that give you a sense of the texture of life, or just playful ways of putting things. And a lot of nuts and bolts things just describing, you know, various interactions or, you know, getting paid for various paintings or having things sent. You know, he's making, you know, practical considerations. But even his more business-like letters often have these little evocative and emotional things couched in them. And so I was intrigued to find that because I didn't know what I would find in the letters. I wanted to look at them because letters are such a personal thing. Sometimes there might even be a photocopy or a facsimile of his original letter, and you see it in his hand and his penmanship, which was also really nice to see just because it's so, you know, florid and deft. But it was so interesting to see a more of a personal dimension of him than I knew about before, just from seeing his work or even being at the place. Well, of course, the mansion itself is such an amazing thing because while it's very opulent, I found it was very different from other, you know, grand houses that are open to the public as museums now. Case in point being the Newport, Rhode Island mansions that were various, you know, tycoons or robber barons and their summer estates that are very spectacular, but they're definitely created to impress, and they're almost kind of oppressive and very gilded and gaudy, whereas I felt like Olana felt more hospitable, and while it's very luxuriant and ornamental, it feels more homey for that kind of a place. And of course, they had all sorts of visitors come up there and stay, including, I read a couple of letters that he'd written to Mark Twain, who was one of the many guests who had stayed there. But it is so interesting to, you know, peer into this more personal dimension, and even to see he had a, you know, he loved his Olana place so much that he didn't really, you know, care so much for urban society, even though he was comfortable in it and had to move in it. In one letter, he even mentioned, the one thing we lack here is society, but then he goes on to say how that's, he doesn't really miss that so much. He'd rather hang out with the local people and have the children be dressed informally and ride around in the log wagon, and that was where it was at for him. And he almost thought of, you know, the company of urban sophisticates as being a kind of a blight. I think he even used the word blight. So there's a lot of, I thought there was a lot of humor.
He doesn't use the term sidiots, does he?
No, but you can feel that sentiment kind of creeping in. I can remember also with, you know, there's, you know, the younger artist Daniel Chester French, the sculptor who did a lot of public sculpture in New York, and some of that is in Central Park, and he's most famous for the Lincoln Memorial sculpture, the sculpture of Lincoln. Well, he had a, you know, kind of a rural studio out in western Massachusetts called Chesterwood, and I can remember visiting there and seeing that he had written something like, New York is New York, but this, you know, his getaway place was his favorite place to be. And he was another person who, you know, was plugged into society in New York City in the 19th century. But as far as he was concerned, where it was at was away from there.
Do you have a specific interest in historical figures from the Hudson Valley? I guess you've done some, you did some Rip Van Winkle work. Because he wasn't really a historical figure per se,
right,
but
he's kind of become one. It's always interesting, yes, too, when fictional characters become, you know, universally beloved and familiar people.
There's a statue of this fictional person in Catskill. Is there any sculptures of real people in Catskill, or just fictional people?
Goodness, that's the only one I can even really think of.
There's cats that appear, but they are also fictional. And they only appear for a month or two.
That's right. And I think that's even done now. I think that they're not going to do it anymore. And those were kind of atop little poles as though they were parking meters. So
less than sculptures, yes.
So they're sculptures, but not... I don't remember seeing statues. No, there is a statue by the courthouse. I think it must be a World War I memorial. And there is a statue. But there's... I don't recall seeing very much statuary in Catskill. And yet you think there would be. Even Rip Van Winkle, he's a statue that lives right in the middle of the street in a crook in the road, and you drive around him.
He gets run into every couple of years too, right?
I haven't seen that happen, but I can't see how that wouldn't happen. Because it's a very vulnerable place to be if you're standing in the middle of the street day and night. But they do put him away in the wintertime.
The snowplows take him out.
He's made of wood. And I don't know why they put him away, maybe to protect him. But he's carved of wood. He's not a bronze statue or a stone statue. He's a wooden statue. But he appears every spring and goes away every winter.
Were there any similarities between Rip Van Winkle and Frederick Church?
I don't know, other than the urge to wander off into the wilderness
into the woods,
and into the mountains, and then to have a kind of otherworldly, mystical experience. Because Rip Van Winkle, to evade scolding, goes up the mountain, and then that's when he starts to run into the mysterious people in the old-fashioned garb, the old-fashioned Dutch garb, and somebody hands him the drink to be quaffed and fixes him in a statue-like stare. And in the narration it says, this was the most melancholic celebration he had ever seen. This strange and eerie experience, and then him, of course, falling asleep for a generation. So in that sense, the Hudson River School painters are of that ilk, escaping the town, escaping civilization, and going up into the mountains and having mystical experiences.
Come in.
As you all know, the Catskill Mountains are just about over that way, and have for generations been considered an enchanted place, as they still are today. Well, at the base of these mountains, if you were to get out on Route 23A, just past 32, the area there between what is now Catskill and what is now Palinville, well, somewhere in there was a small village. In colonial times, and in that village, lived Rip Van Winkle. Well, the story of Rip Van Winkle was found among the papers of the late Dietrich Knickerbocker, who was a fictitious author invented by Geoffrey Crayon, an old Dutch gentleman. He himself was a fictitious author, created by Washington Irving, who, as we now know, is responsible for our knowing the story of Rip Van Winkle.
Gather around and all ye shall hear how Rip Van Winkle fell asleep for 20 years.
One thing I thought was interesting about some of Church's endeavors was how he collected old paintings or collected 16th century paintings. And there was this idea of how, he painted over some of them and added his own parts or changed things about them. And, some people have interpreted that as that he considered that he was improving upon them. Although that didn't really seem to really address the motivation. I kind of feel after reading more about him that, like other romantics or people involved in the transcendentalist movement and looking for a kind of a spiritual, mystical experience, and Thomas Cole was certainly like that, he seemed to be doing that with some of these earlier paintings, and some of them being religious paintings that were Catholic, where he himself was a Presbyterian. And so it's almost seemed to me like, you know, because he had this love of antiquity or wanted to go back 300 years, I kind of felt that he wanted to collaborate with artists of antiquity, and he wanted to merge or have a union with artists from another era who were more connected to some kind of a mystical experience, and this was his way of participating with it. Whereas I think some of his contemporaries felt that in his art collecting, he was collecting paintings that weren't so great, or, you know, why is he wasting his time on this? They had a different frame of reference or a different interest in it than he did. And I think that, and also I think he even deliberately did things to them to age them, to make them look darker. So it's funny that he took this thing that was already old and wanted to amplify their oldness in some way. So that was part of its power for him. So I kind of felt like he wanted to collect these things to commune with the power of the past. And by painting on them, he was participating and collaborating. And that was more the nature of the interest that drove him. It was almost more of a kind of a, like a Rosicrucian impulse than a painterly one.
Is your performance sort of an extension of that?
Well, I mean, partly I'll be declaiming and reading these things out loud so that passersby, who will of course only see just a little section of the performance, which I wanted to be unchanging from beginning to end, never repeat, even though the audience will be changing and flowing constantly, and you just happen to see whatever is going on when you go by. So some of the time I'll be reading from these letters. Some of the time I'll be singing songs that have some sort of connection to the content in the letters or to the period. One of them is, Frederick Church, of course, was interested in exotic locales and cultures, and yet there was a limit to how much he could really know about it. So some of the writing or the characters that looks Arabic was something that he invented or was a fictionalized version, since he didn't really know about the language and even wrote about this, you know, that he was using his imagination to fill in what he didn't know. And so there was this desire for this different kind of mental world, a different kind of aesthetic, exotic artifacts, and he, you know, collected a lot of things from the Middle East. But even the whole idea of an exotic fantasy that people in the West were interested in the East, but you know, didn't know a lot about it yet. And the artist Edward Lear, who's famous for his nonsense poetry and being the inventor of the limerick and making strange little drawings that, from a modern perspective, we would think of as Thurber-esque, very simple pen and ink drawings that are strange and almost look like they're drawn by somebody who's not really used to drawing. But Edward Lear was really known in his day mostly as a landscape painter, and he painted these very realistic landscapes and also natural history illustration, and you know, drew all kinds of birds and drew very realistically, observationally from life. And yet he had this bent of drawing these strange drawings that were entirely from the imagination and not about observing nature at all, and then wrote this kooky poetry. And later the French surrealists were really excited about Edward Lear because they felt that he embodied a kind of a pure fantasy that was independent from the world that he lived in. And he wrote a poem called The Akhand of Swat, which is a kind of a Persian fantasy nonsense poem. And I saw a parallel between his endeavors and Church's. So I'll do a performance of The Akhand of Swat. There's some other letters of Church's where he is writing extensively about pies and how he's on doctor's orders not to eat pies, but he loves them so much and says, oh, if the doctor only knew how good this pie was, he certainly never would have forbidden it. And so there's a thing where he's writing about minced pies. I'm going to pull out a song that comes from a later era called The Hot Minced Pies That Auntie Used to Make. There's a song called Niagara Falls. One of his more famous paintings is a painting of Niagara Falls. I think he even had some involvement in trying to officially have Niagara Falls area be made into a park officially in the era before there were state parks. And there was even talk of maybe doing some dynamiting to, you know, change the appearance of the falls or to make it one uniform flowing area without some rock sticking up in the middle. I can't even remember if such a thing was done or not.
You can almost see the sequence of Church kind of leading to a character like Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, yeah, there's definitely a connection of him being a kind of precursor to Teddy Roosevelt and having and other figures who saw industrialization, you know, creeping in and spoiling the wilderness. And you know, Beatrix Potter, who's famous for the Peter Rabbit books, bought up a lot of land in the north of England to put into a trust specifically to protect it from the encroaching of industrialism and to keep it rural and to keep it unspoiled. And that also she thought her main endeavor really was to be a scientist, a kind of a botanist. And there are these wonderful botanical illustrations she drew of mushrooms that she classified. But also, being a woman in the 19th century, she knew she couldn't get into the old boy network of men and be taken seriously. So she did her work entirely independently and thought of the Peter Rabbit books as mostly a way to fund her scientific research. But it was interesting to discover that this was also part of her endeavor, was to really buy up as much land as she could in the Lake District in order to protect it. So it's interesting to see in the 19th century, you know, different people who thought this was a very important thing to do before it was too late. And in a time when Europe was already deforested and, well, up here in Hunter, New York, there is the wonderful piano museum up at the Doctorow Center where they have many antique pianos. And when I was there, I was told that he said this might seem like a strange place to have a piano museum, but when there was a big demand for pianos in Europe and there wasn't much wood left to manufacture them with, a lot of the pianos were made with lumber from the Catskills, from here, where there was still plenty of wood.
Yeah, I believe the property we're on here in Acre was clear-cut three or four times probably during that period. So this whole area, you know, was a lumber source over and over again, probably for New York City. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Brian DeWan, who's one of the artists who's performing at Groundswell at the Alana State Historic Site Saturday, September 19th from 1 to 5 p.m. He'll be joined by John Cage Truss with Seth Chrisman, John Cleeter, Gambletron, Tyson Hoff, Bernard Klug, Lovid, Douglas Repetto, and Quintron. And Brian, it almost sounds like when you're describing your performance, there's sort of a town crier sensibility to it. Are you going to actually be performing on a soapbox?
Not on a soapbox, but I will have a podium, which serves a similar function. So I'll have a little podium in the outdoors.
Hard to find a soapbox these days anymore. Literally and figuratively, I guess.
So I'll be on one of the carriage trails there, and people will be passing by, and so I'll be something that people go by in the woods, and I'll have a little podium out there from which I'll be reading the letters, but then I'll come out from behind the podium sometimes with an accordion, to walk around with an accordion and sing the occasional sung thing before I go back to declaim from behind the podium. And also sometimes, if it comes up, I'll be even just conversing with people as they pass by if something comes up or if somebody asks me questions. So the performance will consist of reading aloud from letters, singing songs, either with an accordion, a marching snare drum, or unaccompanied. And then, as the spirit moves us, to converse with passersby.
And you already have an established interest in songs that predate the rock and roll era, let's say.
Oh, yes. Well, I love anything that goes back through the generations. And, you know, I haven't really performed medieval things, but sometimes Renaissance things, or certainly when it comes to Americana, you know, probably the oldest thing I know is a late 17th century song called Tobacco's But an Indian Weed, which was written at a time when the smoking of tobacco was still a relatively new thing for Europeans or for Westerners, and it was a strange and exotic custom. In fact, I think originally in the song they used the verb drink rather than smoke. Like it says, think on this when you drink tobacco.
Well, like tea or something?
Well, they thought of the smoke that they conceived of it, that you were drinking the smoke.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So they
didn't use, a milky liquid.
Yeah, so that was the verb you used then before the word smoke was used as a verb. You know,
it was an early version of toke or something.
Yeah.
Tobacco's but an Indian weed, grows green at morn, cut down at eve. It shows our decay, we are but clay. Think on this when you smoke tobacco. The pipe that is so lily white, in which so many take delight, gone with a touch, man's life is such. Think on this when you smoke tobacco. The pipe that is so foul within shows how the soul is stained with sin. It doth require the purging fire. Think on this when you smoke tobacco. The ashes that are left behind doth serve to put us all in mind, that unto dust return we must. Think on this when you smoke tobacco.
So, of course, I love you know, all kinds of musical artifacts that are, you know, before we are born, and yet you see how arbitrary it is that our frame of reference is just the brevity of our own time, our own lifespan on the earth, and that you can go back and just look indefinitely from generation to generation to generation back and look at their experiences and, you know, have a sense of a different kind of a mentality. So that's another kind of exoticism, I suppose.
Can you tell from like working with songs from the American history, is there a time when the song structure changed? Has it always been verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus? Or was there a radical different change somewhere?
Well, some are just very simple, primitive things, just like certain kinds of ballads where you just had a melody that just really goes for two bars, and then you just repeat that over and over and over. So the whole structure is really just A, and that's all you get over and over, because I like the way it's almost like a mechanistic conveyor belt for dishing out a story. And so you have this reciting of what's really a kind of an epic poem with this one melodic figure that repeats over and over. And then later you have more elaborate things with the verse alternated with a chorus. Or then you might even have a little C section or an interlude or an instrumental passage. But I'm very fond of primitive ballads that are just one little hunk of melody that's not even a full-blown melody that you just repeat over and over, and yet the words are always changing, and that's sort of hypnotic and mesmerizing.
Oh, when are you gonna come and see me? Come and see me, come and see me. When are you gonna come and see me, my dear old necklace boy? I think I'll come next Sunday, next Sunday, next Sunday. I think I'll come next Sunday, if the weather is good. Oh, how long do you think you'll court me, you'll court me, you'll court me? How long do you think you'll court me, my dear old necklace boy? I think I'll court you all night, all night, all night. I think I'll court you all night, if the weather is good. Oh, when are we gonna get married, get married, get married? When are we gonna get married, my dear old necklace boy? I think we'll marry in a week, in a week, in a week. I think we'll marry in a week, if the weather is good. Oh, what do we ride to the wedding in, to the wedding in, to the wedding in? What do we ride to the wedding in, my dear old necklace boy? I think I'll bring my log sled, my log sled, my log sled. I think I'll bring my log sled, if the weather is good. Well, why not bring your buggy, your buggy, your buggy? Why not bring your buggy, my dear old necklace boy? The ox won't work to the buggy, to the buggy, to the buggy. The ox won't work to the buggy, 'cause I never seen him try. Oh, we're gonna bring to the wedding, to the wedding, to the wedding. Who are you gonna bring to the wedding, my dear old necklace boy? I think I'll bring my children, my children, my children. I think I'll bring my children, if the weather is good. Oh, I didn't know you had any children, any children, any children. Oh, I didn't know you had any children, my dear old necklace boy. Oh, yes, I have six children, six children, six children. Oh, yes, I have six children, Joe, Jim, John, Sally, and the baby. Run and tell Aunt Mary, Aunt Mary, Aunt Mary. Run and tell Aunt Mary, the old gray goose is dead. The one that she's been saving, been saving, been saving. The one that she's been saving to make a feather bed.
Is the subject matter that different? I mean, there's often love songs, and then there's often songs about like processes and technologies of the day, which I'm sure are different in different eras. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of songs about the Morse code and the railroad, you know, in the late 1800s.
Oh yeah, well, in a lot of songs you see references to those things, you know, either as just a contemporary commonplace or even hailing them as something that is an exotic and new thing. In fact, there's a 19th century song called Uncle Sam's Farm, you know, where the words, you know, are talking about, you know, our rolling rivers are just the thing for washing sheep and driving cotton mills, and we send our news by lightning on the telegraphic wires. And so there's this kind of an enthusiasm about how the founding fathers never dreamed of our mighty age of steam. The words in some of the words in that song. And of course, some songs sometimes have things like references to things we don't know about anymore, and it almost becomes by default a sort of nonsense poem. There's a wonderful essay by George Orwell called Nonsense Poetry, and he talks about how his favorite nonsense poetry comes from medieval folk poetry, where a lot of the references are lost, but the language still has this evocative power, which I think is exactly right, it's very exciting to hear songs where you don't even know what they're talking about because the meaning is lost, but nonetheless, it's poetic and colorful and touches us even though we can't understand the references.
They're making references to like past technologies, like there was probably a whole rich language around blacksmiths and and there's probably a lot of words about changing horses' horseshoes that we don't know all nobody retains all the slang terms for all that.
Right, and the idea that would be like such a part of your life, such a commonplace in your life that's now
everybody had to change
gone.
A horseshoe.
Yeah.
You didn't know how to change a horseshoe. Anyway, we're talking with Brian DeJuan, who's going to be at Groundswell and reading some of the letters and performing some songs of the era. What do you have? Can you tell us any couple of songs that you're going to be performing of the era? You mean is the during Frederick Church's lifetime, yeah. And when yeah. Alana was created. Yeah.
Some of them are from the era, and some of them are not. The connection being more the a specific reference in letters. Well, there's one that was contemporary in his lifetime that was a sentimental Victorian song called When 100 Years Have Rolled, which seems apropos for such a endeavor. There's another one also contemporary to him. One of his letters is referring about mortgaging some property, or I think mortgaging a farm, and there's a Grange Hall song I had learned called Do Not Mortgage the Farm, which has lines in it like, think of the time it has taken, think of the toil it has cost, now do not let it be lost, do not imperil the homestead, think of how you want your children to own it someday, and then the chorus is, do not mortgage the farm, do not mortgage the farm, for sorrow will sure overtake you if ever you mortgage the farm. So I'll be doing that. Also, because of the connection with Niagara Falls, I'll be doing a song that was really written, more 100 years after the death of Frederick Church. It's called Niagara Falls. That was written by an autistic songwriter named Dana C. Drake, which is a humorous song about Niagara Falls. And I'll be doing a folk hymn called Heavenly Union, which will tie into his painting on these old paintings with angels and whatnot. The hot mince pies that Auntie used to make, which I had mentioned earlier, and Edward Lear's poem, The Akond of Swat. So that's... And then I'll be doing some other things, too, that are not historical songs, but that are just on the idea of... changes in fashion, changes in intellectual fashion. Frederick Church's paintings were very popular and valuable in his own lifetime, but also in his own lifetime he saw his style of painting go out of fashion to be, displaced by some other thing, and there wasn't as much demand for it anymore. So a big thing of what I'll be doing has to do with that idea of changing tastes, changing fashions, changing customs, and yet how fleeting even those changes are. Of course now, after enough time goes by, something is revered forever as an antique or a classic. But first it has to go through that period of being disrespected or considered yesterday's news or is garbage because now it's out of fashion. But then it reemerges as a kind of a phoenix from the ashes, as something venerated and antique, which happens in every era.
The 8-track is about to have that same thing, right?
Yeah, well, once the thing is, long ago enough, it's no longer yesterday's garbage, and it's an exotic artifact to be revered and beloved.
And we're leaving out one part of your performance that's going to be at Groundswell Saturday, September 19th, from 1 to 5 p.m., as I heard you're also may be performing with Quintron, too?
Yes, I just heard from him, and he was asking if I wanted to participate in a performance that he is doing. So I wrote back and said I would love to. So we'll work out the details.
Is this going to be the first duet of the Dewanatron and the Drum Buddy?
oh, I don't even know. I'm just beginning to find out. And I don't know if, you know, other people may be performing too. So I don't even know what it will be. But whatever it will be, I'm looking forward to it.
Because you have kind of old-timey sets that you do that it sounds like your set is going to fit in with here. But you also have this kind of electronic well, you use the Duantron, the instrument that you've created.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Duantron instruments are a collaboration with my cousin Leon, and so we think them up together, and he makes the circuits, and I make the consoles that they're in. And so I might bring one of those instruments, but I also have some other, you know, old vintage synths, which I got in the era when, just like we were talking about, people considered them to be garbage, and everyone was in love with the new digital technology, which had some advantages, too. It was more stable. It was more easily controlled. And so I got a number of wonderful, you know, 1970s analog synthesizers because they were not valued, because they were considered garbage. But today, they are valuable antiques that are sought after. And you got to shell out the dough. So the idea of picking it out of a trash can is over.
So your set then with Quintron may sound slightly different than your solo set. On it's somewhere along the path outside of Alana. Do you know where exactly you are?
I am. I don't really know what sort of a point of reference I would have. That's not.
Which way? What do you see when you perform?
Well, there isn't really anything to see, as far as I'm concerned. It just seems more like there's a bend in the path, and you're surrounded with trees. So you're really just
in the forest,
in the woods, and you don't see out. There is this one little area that's kind of full of dirt and leaves that slopes up behind. But it's more of an interior space than something where you see into the distance. So in a way, it's almost like a sort of a little alcove by the side of the road.
Are you going to be dressed in 18th century or 19th century garb and holding a zither? Is that how people are going to find you, like Rip Van Winkle lost on the path?
No, but I will be. I'll be really more in a kind of a period 20th century costume. So there are many layers of, you know, and particularly the layer when, you know, Olana goes out of the hands of the descendants of Frederick Church and then is bought by the New York State Parks Department to become a public place, and which is something we take for granted now that it's something open to the public. But I guess in the early 60s, it was most likely just going to change over into private hands, and who knows what would have happened to it. Or even in the 60s, so many 19th century things were demolished because they were considered old-fashioned, so who knows, maybe...
Could have some dot-com millionaire up there now with the windmills and smokestacks and...
Well, they could have even just knocked down the building and put up a modernist building. So anyway, because in the 60s... And, you know, that was when the... That's even before the Landmarks Commission even existed, right before, because I had heard about how it was the demolition of Penn Station in New York City that people were so outraged by that was the catalyst to begin there being such a thing as a Landmarks Commission. And I heard that and that was demolished in 1966. And in the late 60s, they were going to demolish Grand Central Station. And the only reason that was prevented was there was already so much outrage from the demolition of Penn Station. So that was a real low ebb for Victorian things, when people thought of Victorian things as garbage. And while I doubt somebody would have raised the house at Olana, you know, who knows what would have happened to it. And it's great that it actually became.
It's a different point up public. Here in the 60s and 70s, because you could see, like, New York City, when those buildings, it could have turned worse up here. Nobody could have made Olana a protected national park. There could have been a nuclear power plant, down the river that was discussed in the 70s. And so it could, the Hudson Valley viewshed around Alana could be a very different place right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it is amazing to think of how different it could have been had those efforts not been made several decades ago. So we're very fortunate about that.
All right, anything else you want to tell folks about your performance at Groundswell Saturday, September 19th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Alana State Historic Site? up the hill from the Rip Van Winkle Bridge.
Well, I'm so pleased to be participating in it this year. I've been to the Groundswells the other 2 years, and it's just such a delightful thing to be in that landscape and as you go along encounter these different things as you go up the path. So it's very exciting, and to be outdoors and to have these different performances as you move around.
Yeah, the first year there was artists that put up, E-Team, I think, put up artificial clouds along the path in the view shed. And then the second year there were you were kind of fogged in with actual clouds, right?
That's right. The second year we had inclement weather. The first year there was supposed to be bad weather, and then it turned out to be beautiful. And that was also the first time I'd seen that part that they had recently cleared. So you really see the view out towards the river and towards the Rip Van Winkle Bridge. And it's just incredible. The views are just so beautiful there. So
if you've never been, you should definitely take a hike or drive the car up the Alana State Historic Site Hill and take a look.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just such a good place. You never get tired of it.
All right, well, we'll go out on that note then. Thank you, Brian DeWan, and we'll see you Saturday, September 19th at Groundswell at the Alana State Historic Site.
All right.
East End was once a happy town where harmony and love was busting out at all the seams and in the trees above. The doves of peace were laying eggs. There were no signs of strife, for each man loved his neighbor and sometimes his neighbor's wife. But a sudden change soon come about. Storm clouds were in the sky. Nobody stopped to kiss a body coming through the rye. For each man eyed his neighbor with malice and with hate. Housewives no longer spilled the beans across the garden gate. We had a war, a civil war. Folks often asked us what we're fighting for. Well, most of us wanted water mains and sewers and bathtubs too. But the rest of them decided they'd make the slop pails do. It was sewer pipes versus slop pails. The town was split in two. With profane propaganda, the air was often blue. The sewer and water faction ran a sanitary plank. They said shallow wells and slop pails and toilets always stank. We had a war, a civil war. Folks often asked us what we're fighting for. Well, most of us wanted water mains and sewers and bathtubs too. But the rest of them decided they'd make the slop pails do. But those slop pailers were stubborn. They fought with tooth and nail. They said our nitwit council should be languishing in jail. They told how high taxation and plumbers' union fees would throw us in the poorhouse and they'd throw away the keys. We had a war, a civil war. Folks often asked us what we're fighting for. Well, most of us wanted water mains and sewers and bathtubs too. But the rest of them decided they'd make the slop pails do. But when the vote was counted, the slop pailers met defeat. And then they started tearing up our quiet village street. Now peace and harmony once more replaced the grapes of wrath. So when next you visit East End, just stop in and have a bath. We had a war, a civil war. Folks often asked us what we're fighting for. Well, most of us wanted water mains and sewers and bathtubs too. But the rest of them decided